All right, I'll call this special meeting of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. This is Friday, January 12th. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. And we're here to hear a report from Soiring Consulting. First thing is to establish a quorum. We have all three commissioners present. And with that, we'll ask our consultants to introduce themselves for the record, and then I believe you have a PowerPoint presentation, and commissioners will have some questions, and then after the presentation, we'll take public input. We ask the individuals that wish to comment to limit their comments to 5 minutes, and limit your comments to the consulting report. So with that, you're on.
Okay.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for all attending. We're really happy to be here and share our findings with our assessment. My name is Joan Estes. I was a project manager, and we were just thrilled with the support that we got while we were on site. I had had an extensive career in healthcare. In fact, I retired 3 times, and my current boss keeps calling me back, so I'm going to have to learn how to retire, but I think that's coming up. But I have spent most of my career in the private sector. I've had experiences as an administrative director. I've opened up a freestanding ambulatory surgery center. I was a director of patient care services in an acute care setting and opened up a psychiatric facility for adults and pediatrics. I worked in the acute care setting in many years in the perioperative services. So my career is varied across different sectors of healthcare. I've been consulting now for over 24 years. It's been a real highlight in my life because the experiences I have received and achieved while I've been consulting have just been phenomenal for me. So, if, you know, at a point in time when I really retire, I'm going to really be able to look back and think, you know, I've had a great life, but it's time for me to just say, sayonara. But again, been with Soiring Consulting for 24 years, and we've recently been acquired by Chris Ganey. That's been quite a change for us, and it's moving us into, you know, a little different product line, service line for us. But Dean and I have been really excited about the opportunities that we have with Press Gaming. Dean.
Dean Vanderhoof. I think I met most everybody in this room, or at least talked on the phone with everybody. Like Joan, I've been in healthcare since I can't remember which. I got a job as a phlebotomist in 1976 when I was an undergrad at University of Missouri. Got a degree in biology and a degree in chemistry, thinking that I wanted to teach in a medical school someday. Never wanted to be a doctor, didn't think I liked people that much. And I certainly didn't want to work that hard. But worked in research chemistry for about 10 years, and when I turned 30, I went, I got to do something. So I looked at a PhD program in anatomy at the University of Cincinnati, and I also went to Xavier University and interviewed for, or talked to them about a master's in healthcare and hospital administration, made that decision like that. When I entered Xavier, didn't even own a suit. I had a couple of ties. So that was a major transition for me to get comfortable in that. But since then, I did my residency at St. Thomas Hospital in Nashville. There a few years, went to ProMedica Health System in Toledo, Ohio. Spent another 8 years, and then got called back to Nashville when Ascension Health bought Baptist, and we turned an 800-bed hospital around to where they were profitable for the first time in 8 years. And since then, I've done various things, including the creation of ambulatory surgery center management companies, started the first acute care hospital dedicated to chronic pain patients in Scottsdale, Arizona, which was the vision of a successful pain management doc down there. And just like Joan, I've loved every minute of it. And people have asked me, with everything going around in healthcare these days, would you do it again? And I always say, in a minute. Because throughout my entire career, the people who actually take care of the patient allowed me to hang with them. And it was energizing to see people basically have a calling in taking care of a patient. And it's been a significant part of my life. So that's me.
All right.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you. I am going to start with this one slide. And for those of you who can't see it, look at that first slide, and I'll let you read it. And then I'll tell you why I put it in there.
Sir, you're in the way of the place.
Oh. Thank
you.
Sir.
You got this.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Thomas Hobbes, but he was a philosopher that lived in the mid-1600s. Okay?
Past.
The reason this is here is the first time that Joan and I sat with Wayne Belmont for an hour. The first half of the hour, we talked about the history of Lincoln County, Wayne's role in his as general counsel, talked some about the structure, talked some about the structure of HHS, and so we went through all that, and we got to know each other pretty well. That second half of that hour, we talked about this, the anxiety for the future time. All right. Unlike pharmaceutical companies in this country, I don't believe anxiety is necessarily a bad thing. It's a motivator, right? It's all these things that contribute to just wanting to move forward. Oh, pardon the old English and the sexist part of this, but the nice thing about it is that the anxiety calls us to look at our current situations and then make decisions to make the future better. And that summarized this conversation that Joan and Wayne and I had from the get-go. And the whole idea is that when we walked out into the rest of HHS, that feeling was consistent across everybody we met. We just want to do it better. We just want to do things the right way. Several matters of evidence that happened through that and support that. The second thing that I wanted to bring up Thomas Hobbes is that he had a really good quote. I couldn't find it. I can't put it in a passage because it's like four or five pages. But he said that discourse between two or more people contains no truth. And I went, what? And when I reread it, it says, no, it has no truth. And in this day and age, when we talk about discourse and truths, is PBS truthful? Is Fox News? Are presidential tweets? Are Facebook? The discourse that goes back and forth on Facebook? No. And what Hobbes finally said was, discourse is the pursuit of truths. So you guys invited us in your discourse about HHS in the future. We are honored by that and humbled by it, and we're on this journey with you. So with that, I'll leave this over to Joan, and she can do her part of the presentation.
Okay, and I'll be speaking to the clinical or the clinic section, and Dean will speak to the financials and the marketing aspects of the businesses. So overall, I'm speaking to the commissioners here. We were asked by Lincoln County Health System to come in and do a comprehensive assessment of the Health and Human Services system. And you say, well, what does a comprehensive assessment include? And we've, you know, dropped down some bullets of, you know, what are the elements in operations and practice that we would look at. And it runs from the financials to org structure, scheduling, clinics, practices. And so overall, it's very comprehensive looking, you know, throughout the health system. What we were also asked to do is, all right, if you made the observations, then, you know, what are some recommendations for improvement for what you have seen? And for us to explain and make sure everybody understands, when Dean and I came on board, we did some observations. We walked through some of the clinics. We talked to some of the staff. We watched the patient flow and registration. We also spoke to staff so we could get their perspectives on, you know, what is actually our job? You know, what are some of the issues we deal with and perhaps some opportunities there? And then the other piece that we looked at was some data, you know, to support our findings. And so that is actually the methodology that we implemented for our assessment process. We always, in a presentation, speak to the strengths of the organizations that we are presenting to. And as an organization, you have a number of strengths that you can be, you know, extremely proud of. The Board of Commissioners is a strong board, and you have to be commended because they're the ones who said, you know, let's look at what we're doing, you know, how can we do it better, particularly when you're looking at the future for, you know, whether it's a building or expanding your services. But, you know, as a board, you need to be commended for your objectivity in where you are and where you want to go. Lincoln County Health and Human Services is extremely interested and focused on providing quality care for the patients and their families. And we found that across the board. You know, it was every day Dean and I would, you know, make a mention of, well, it was this particular service or this particular employee. But we were extremely impressed with the vision, you know, and the sensitivity that the staff have for the work that they are providing. So that leads into the third bullet where we're talking about you have a very committed team. But whatever takeaway you have for this presentation, this last bullet is really the most important because we were extremely impressed with the caliber of the services that you provide to your patients. It's very diverse. It's visionary. You address all of the divisions, you know, that you currently provide the services. And so that is one thing you need to be extremely proud of because the caliber of the services you provide are exceptional. So looking overall at the opportunities and issues we looked at, you can see there's a number of opportunities. And as we go through the sections, you know, we'll talk about, you know, what are some of the opportunities whether for the Board of Commissioners. Looking at, you know, how can the organizational structure be enhanced, you know, to provide perhaps more clarity. Looking at some staffing oversight that will help, you know, with the growing population that you have in your services, the increasing services that you provide. So the key opportunities that you have are amazing. And for all of the issues and opportunities that Dean and I have looked at, we have seen nothing that really can't be addressed and or fixed or move forward. So that's a positive for everyone who's looking at this presentation. We pulled up this slide. Dean put this together for us because overall we were looking at, you know, a significant amount of data to get the answers for when we were looking at staffing and or the services provided in your divisions. And we could pull up the 2016 to try and get the comprehensive data. But, you know, when looking at the data, and Dean will go into this more, you know, in his section, you know, we would be looking at, you know, what are visits for behavior health? You know, is that, you know, a contact by the physician? You know, is that a group contact? So, you know, we would be looking at some definitions for visits so we're very clear. Behavioral health, for instance, there's at least 5 different service lines in behavioral health. Well, is it IDD that's growing the fastest and has the most, or is it the adult services? So breaking out the data for moving forward is going to be a key element for your practices. So when we address the board of directors, and Dean stated it very well, we had an opportunity to visit with each one of the commissioners individually, and they gave us, you know, their perspectives. They each have individual roles, you know, for what Bill, you know, has for his responsibilities, and Doug and Terry. But you also shared with us the community issues. And, you know, we could do 3 county assessments in a row, but every community is different. It's the profile of the services you provide. It's the community issues that you address on a day-to-day basis. And so you shared with us some of the community issues that you have to address, you know, currently for Lincoln County. And you're looking at, you know, the population that high homeless, the problems that you have for reasonable housing, a high senior citizen population. So all of these profiles, you know, impact the services that you provide. So looking at some recommendations for the Board of Commissioners, we look at recommending that you continue to provide the comprehensive services for health and human services, and that was one of the questions that we saw and immediately up front. Are we providing the right services? Are these services needed for Lincoln County? And, you know, overall, you know, the need is there. You provide wonderful services, and you need to just, you know, continue providing these comprehensive services. Moving forward, there's an opportunity and need to evaluate revenue options. You know, you have to address, number one, the growth that you have in your services you provide, but you also are looking at the new building, you know, to house all your services, and that's going to need, you know, the revenue to support it. So there is a need for to continue evaluate some revenue opportunities for the new building. You know, there is some opportunities to look at and address the leadership opportunities in health and human services. As I addressed initially, the data piece is very important, and you will see that throughout the report, the need for more data, whether it's staffing, whether it's the utilization, or whether it's finances. Looking at the responsibilities for, you know, the direction for the director for health and human services is an important factor. And, you know, I'm not saying that's not done, but that is very important, particularly for moving forward. So looking at the comprehensive aspects for operations and practice for health and human services, we looked at the organizational structure. You actually have 5, I believe, organizational structures, but they all represent the same outline, but one is comprehensive for all of the divisions, including finance. There's another one that just reports and represents the leadership in the divisions for health and human services. 2 of them include staffing on the organizational structures, and that's not a typical structure, that model that we see, because the FTEs are continually changing. You know, you have people terminating, you have new people moving in, and so it's a bit of a mix between what we call position control and the organizational structure. One of the issues we were looking at the model for the organizational structure is that it was not a consistent framework that we could actually pick out and determine. And some of the examples that we have listed here is, number one, support services you will find under the assistant finance director. And that's not a typical organizational breakout that you see. You know, you would typically see finance dealing, you know, typically with the finance pieces for Health and Human Services. Again, there's some discrepancies or, you know, inconsistencies where the some of the managers report and or the medical assistants and or the office assistants. And so when you look at it, you know, overall, it's confusing. It was very confusing for us, and we spent a lot of time reviewing the org structure to make sure we understood it, you know, and could determine where we needed to move forward, you know, with some recommendations. And so our recommendations are clear. You know, implement a consistent division model, streamline it, look at some of your position descriptions so there's clarity between what is the director and what are the division directors and their responsibilities. Look at, you know, some enhancement for the assistant finance director, because we're looking at, you know, and some expectations for more detailed reports for finances, not just overall organizationally, but broken out by divisions. And you'll see, you know, when we speak to the individual divisions and staff, they really would like and would seek more input and more data to help them with their day-to-day operations for their divisions. Personnel department, we spend a great deal of time and can't say enough about Michael and his staff for how they helped us. And I didn't know, between Michael and Cheryl, we were able to navigate the 10 days we were on site, but they did a fine job getting us to where and identifying where we needed to be, get the staff to, you know, be available to talk to us. And I think that was an extremely important feature in why Dean and I felt like we had a very successful 10 days on site. Personnel spends a great deal of time working with Health and Human Services. They provide the exit interviews. They conduct employee satisfaction surveys on a regular basis. They process all the evaluations. But one of the issues with personnel is looking at, as you're looking at recruitment and or retention issues, that's not a new issue for the county, but personnel has a focus on the recruitment piece. And we would be looking at, you know, providing more opportunity for the clinical staff to be looking at how can they participate more in the retention of the employees. Dean and I were extremely excited about your opportunity for implementing Kronos to your tracking system for the entire system. It's a very popular system. It is actually one that we probably see more of than any of the other systems. There's a lot of them out there. But, you know, it's a fine system, and the reason we're excited about it is because this will provide you, you know, a very expanded details on your staffing, your times of day, your utilization. So you've picked, you know, a fine system, and it will be a great help to you. So the recommendations for personnel would be to implement the Kronos system. And, you know, we talked to where the Kronos system was, you know, going to be implemented, and, you know, talking about what are some of the elements that would be important for having Kronos. And Dean was very, very emphatic about saying, you know, be sure that you purchase the analytics model. Now, at a particular time, and we were talking with Michael, he wasn't really sure that was included, but it would be a very important feature for you to consider in the purchase. Another aspect of the system was looking at, should we continue the payroll twice a month now that you have? There was, you know, some talk about, well, should we go to monthly? However, our recommendation at this point in time is to do the two-week payroll system. It's the more common practice. It's a stable practice, and it lends itself well to data analysis and data reports, because every 2 weeks it's a cycle of staffing in your divisions. As far as leadership, you have a director. Cheryl is a very experienced director. She's had many years in public health. She's even has been a health care consultant. She does report to the commissioner, Commissioner Hunt, and what we would look at for in some leadership, some perceptions for staff would be looking at what are some of the issues in the exit interviews of staff. What are some of the inconsistent staff scheduling issues and or scheduling changes? And I won't go through each one, but there are, and as we go through the clinical divisions, you'll see that staff are looking for an opportunity and would like to be able to participate in looking at some of these aspects of their lives, their work, and see if, you know, they can work through some of these issues and particularly opportunities. We provided a slide here to show you, and we'll have several of them through. Won't spend a lot of time on it, but I do want you to look at how you can see the breakdown in the percent of staff, and the middle graph shows the direct providers. And so overall in Health and Human Services, there's just under 50% of your overall staff that provide direct care. That's higher than we typically see. And what we would, you know, envision if moving forward and getting data would be to provide some benchmarks or some targets for you to look at. So look at and to say at this on this particular slide, we have 38% that's devoted to administrative and administrative support. So there needs to be a balance. But you'll see throughout all the divisions, it's very different. So recommendations for leadership would be to conduct an annual evaluation, looking at revising the position, because the position is more of an administrative and or executive level. It would clearly separate the distinction between the directors that you talk about. Well, those are the division directors, and then we have Cheryl's position. And then looking at continued leadership development, we're not just talking about at the director level, but we're talking about at the manager level and down into the organization. And an opportunity that Dean found is to foster community outreach, because in his report he'll talk to you about some of the external stakeholders and some of the facts that he found and some of the opportunities you have, you know, to work with some of your partners out there in healthcare. I apologize that some of the slides are busy, but we tried to restrict, you know, our presentation, because there was a lot of observations, but, you know, in the, you know, trying to conserve time, we pulled out some of the key issues. But, you know, as you read through the slide, you'll see, you know, the number of divisions. And this is, you know, what everybody understands. But the divisions are all different for the number of service lines that they provide, the number of FTEs that they provide, the managers they have, and particularly the percent vacancies. And in doing some research on vacancies, particularly in community health facilities across the country, you really are no different. It's a difficult area to recruit for. You have a lot of competition across the country. So looking at 18%+, you know, is pretty much a norm across the country. It's high. You know, most organizations say 18% vacancy is a hardship, and it is, because you have a lot of vacancies, positions that aren't filled. Looking at some of the common problems, when I go through public health and look through behavior health, you'll see that there's a theme. There are some commonalities across the divisions, but we'll speak, you know, just broadly about them, but you will see themes. So we're looking at facilities and space, and now that's not a new finding for anybody. But it is a serious issue, and it really hampers the staff. It impedes the throughput and flow, and, you know, it certainly brings to forefront the need for looking at, you know, how can we, you know, pull together these facilities in a new building and improve all these problems. You can see there's staffing issues. Through the divisions, you see that there's sharing of staff across the division lines. It could be public health. It could be in behavioral health. There are staffing guidelines that we would be looking at and seeing, you know, how can there be opportunities to improve, you know, the lives and benefits of the staff. We keep talking about, you know, staff and how they provide all their services, and they put their heart in it. But, you know, we need to look at what we call a work and life balance. And there doesn't seem to be a balance right now for them. And, you know, that's something that, you know, you could discuss and find. But I think you would have, you know, opportunities for improvement along those lines. One of the comments for the public health is that it has grown so fast, it's draining services and facilities. And I don't think that's just public health. That's probably all your service lines. So as far as recommendations for public health, there is the public health division director is also a manager for protection services. And so when I talk about the inconsistencies in the models, you know, you look at, you know, do your service lines all have managers? And, you know, you can't do a stamp for each and every one, but you need to look at, you know, how can there be a more consistent model for, you know, the managers report to the directors. Coordinate division issues with other division directors, and this is important, you know, for all of the divisions, talking about the staff scheduling and the communication guidelines between the divisions and a disconnect between services. And some of the staff comments in, you know, we're talking about, and I think it's behavioral health, you know, they also talk about there's not only a disconnect between the divisions, but also, you know, within behavioral health. They would like to see more a better distribution for communication and staffing and how to, you know, solve the patient care issues that they experience on a day-to-day basis. On the administrative assistant, it was one of the inconsistencies that we saw and would talk about. The recommendation is to share the administrative assistant for public health and primary care. Those two divisions have almost as many staff as behavioral health. So behavioral health is twice the size of both of them. And the administrative assistant was shared for behavioral health. And because of the size and the scope of the services behavioral health, that would be a recommendation, you know, look and, you know, change the reporting and provide more administrative assistance for behavioral health. Now here is the chart for FTEs for public health. And you see, whereas overall we had less than a 50% direct care distribution, here in public health we have 61.5% direct care. So it is, you know, a better distribution of your FTEs. And you can see the administrative support on the left and the management on the right are about equal. So this one has, you know, a better balance, and you would want to see more FTEs provided to direct care rather than to administrative support. And, you know, it's easy for me to, you know, just, you know, say that globally, but when you look at your staffing, and you'll see we have very, very clear recommendation for conduct of staffing analysis, then you would look clearly at what constitutes administrative support. You know, what should constitute administrative support? So that when you're looking at, you know, what should you have for administrative support, it's consistent across the service lines. Primary care is the second largest division. They do have some variance in services that they provide in their division. Primarily, they provide the VA clinic, and they do have the high school-based services. So it's a diverse service line, and they have, as far as their vacancy rate, they have a lesser vacancy rate. And in fact, when we met with the staff in this particular service line. You know, they seem like a very cohesive group. They have perhaps less turnover, and it's demonstrated here in their vacancy rate. So, you know, there are some opportunities, you know, if you look back and say, you know, is there a better balance on this, and is perhaps that why, you know, they're more comfortable with the services that they provide. So just some clarification on the high school-based centers, because that's not something that we typically see to the extent that you provide it. You provide an exceptional service line to these four high schools that are included in your service lines. Dean and I went and spent time in each clinic and were very impressed. As far as the only issue that was of significance in the high school opportunities was staff did report that they're having issues with the EKG machines. The biomed people look at them when they check them. Well, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. So I think, you know, they need to have a serious look at, you know, how old are our EKG machines? Have they, exceeded their service life? And how do we make sure that they are actually going to work when we need them? So recommendations for primary care, because they specifically indicated that they would like to have increased input in division operations. Evaluate staffing needs. There's a great deal of sharing between the divisions, and that's appropriate and common, you know, for the service you provide. But how can you provide more clarity and consistency for staffing, you know, across the divisions? This third bullet, when you identify the deficits, when you're talking about space allocation, because every division needs more space, the rooms are too small, the flow isn't good. But look at, you know, providing, you know, a somewhat of a lead position to pull together all the facility needs for all three divisions, so that there can be, not that there's not a lack of objectivity, but when you look at all three divisions, you know, at one time, then hopefully the decisions will be more balanced, you know, and meet more of the staffing needs. Here's the primary care FTE division. You can see this one isn't as good, but it is a 57.5% of direct care. Administrative support is higher in primary care, but you see where management is down. Behavioral health, as we indicated earlier, has the highest number of FTEs. They account for 43% of the health and human services staff. They provide services in three areas. They're very busy services. And as far as the organizational chart goes, and when we looked at it, there were 30-some positions open. You have a 31.7% vacancy rate. And that really is hampering, you know, the services that you provide. Looking at all the services, psychiatric services, the co-occurring disorders, family, adults, and IDD, the intellectual developmental disabilities. And I think, you know, of all the areas that we talked to, that was the one that we seem to have the greatest angst for, because they're growing fast. The facility, you know, where they provide the services, it's Western Title Building. The flow, you know, isn't good for patients. They've got a significant number of provider, you know, problems that they have to address and work through on a daily basis. The mobile crisis team is a new service. They're working at developing and implementing it. There should be some opportunities for the crisis team for staffing, because a number of the positions on that team, in fact, most of them are open at this time. So staff are having to cover call, and there are some restrictions on how staff are allowed to take back time. And it's policy, and that they can only take it in the week in which it's incurred. And when we talked in depth about it, we understand why why it is set up that way. But it is not a good practice, for number one, for the patients, because the patients are already scheduled. So if you pull the staff out of that milieu, then you're rescheduling your patients. So, you know, overall, there needs to be, you know, more opportunity for how the staff will take their time back for the crisis team. So recommendations for behavioral health, you know, again, looking at the division manager is also providing the manager coverage for psychiatric services. So how can we spin that off? Because if you will look here, I'm going to show you this real quick and then I'm going to go back. Look at the management percent for behavioral health. And if you and there's a slide in a little bit that shows all four of them, but you can see, you know, the this is the lowest percent of management support for behavioral health. Again, we talked about the administrative assistant position that should be dedicated to behavioral health. Evaluate some of the staffing at division levels and develop a plan to provide integration of services. And because this group was the one that said they would like to see more opportunity for sharing, not only in behavioral health, but across the divisions. So this would be an opportunity, you know, to bring the staff in to help them, you know, work through some of these staffing issues and how they can improve the care that they are providing on a day-to-day basis. Overall staffing, if those of you remember, we did hand out surveys to the staff. We did get, I thought for the timeliness that we, you know, handed them out, we had a very good, you know, representation, you know, and return on it. But personnel and staffing concerns were the highest reported concerns for staff, reported back from the questionnaires. So when we were also looking at, all right, staffing and looking at, we are aware that there's issues with sharing, not only within the division, but across service lines, the staffing schedules are different for all three divisions. And, you know, because the way they operate now, there isn't a sharing. And so looking at and trying to figure out how you can match three different schedules so it's, you know, a comfortable outcome was difficult. We spent a lot of time, you know, looking at the staffing schedules and trying to get an understand for the flow and feel of it. As far as the evidence of staffing, we looked at the FTEs that we showed, you know, with the bar graphs for the variances in them. And we didn't see evidence that their staffing benchmarks for, all right, you know, how many patients should they see in behavioral health? How many patients a day should WIC see? How many home visits should be? So when you're looking at your staffing, you have numbers that you can justify and say, I need more staff in WIC because if I have X number of patients to see, you know, on a weekly basis and I have only X number of staff, the numbers justify. You know, they could come back absolutely opposite, but I don't believe that's the case. But when you have numbers and data to support, you know, your needs and requests, you know, you're more likely to, number one, understand the request and certainly move forward in fixing these staffing issues that they're dealing with. As far as looking at job descriptions, I was surprised that there are so many job descriptions. You have nearly, for every job description, for every 1.92 employees. So I think streamlining your job descriptions, you know, and pulling them down to a greater commonality across the line will help you, particularly when you're looking at staffing. And particularly when you're going to say, let's develop a position control, because you already have some of the positions on your org structures. But I spent a great deal of time looking at the org structures and trying to say, okay, how many counselors do we have in the behavioral health line for IDD? And how many counselors do we have in the adult? And so position control will help you pull those numbers together better. So rather than just look and say, well, behavioral health has, you know, the most employees and it's, you know, X number of FTEs, you have an under clear understanding of where they break out. And especially moving forward, when you clearly identify what your needs are, you can move forward. So in the FTE distribution, this is just a graph that shows you how they compare across the lines, but we also have one that shows you, it's a little easier. They have the same numbers, the same percents, but some people are better with bar graphs than looking at numbers. So you can see where there's not a balance, where the, you know, you have inconsistent you know, representation for staff, whether it's management, direct care, or support staff. So recommendations for staffing would be revise the staffing guidelines. And overall, we did recommend that you look at developing a very formal professional practice council. And that would help you bring your staff in so there could be more input into, you know, the decision-making piece for staffing and scheduling. Dean and I talked, and I think you have some mechanism for pulling in your staff now, but why we are looking at, you know, developing perhaps a higher level or a more structured professional practice council is because you've seen staff say they don't feel like they have input, and they want input. And so, you know, perhaps something like this practice council, you know, would be, you know, a vehicle for that. And using them when you're looking at the staffing guidelines, pulling them in to share, you know, and come up with the recommendation. And separate the position control out of your organizational chart. You can look at your position control and clearly see where your FTEs are, where their need is, and if you need to shift up or shift down, you know, it'll be easier on a position control model. I don't know if you've worked with a position control model. I'm sure Cheryl has because that's part of the organizational chart, but, you know, pulling it out, I think, would simplify it, particularly when we say it's imperative that moving forward you do a comprehensive staffing analysis. And as far as medical providers, you did have a period of time where you did not have a full-time medical director. And it was evident to us, you know, the absence of that. But I do understand that you made an offer. Is that correct?
I'm getting an indication that we have not.
Okay. Well, we were of the understanding.
We'll pursue that question.
Yeah, that at least they had a candidate that they were pursuing, you know, with a strong opportunity for making an offer.
Yeah. And I don't know what the status of that is. I don't know if it's candidates declined or if we're still in negotiations.
Yeah.
But something we can follow up.
Yes. With. Yeah. Yeah. And the providers really, really felt like they needed to have more opportunities for input. They didn't feel like they were respected as professionals. And we didn't see any evidence of anything like that, you know, when we were, you know, observing them, you know, out in the areas. But, you know, their perceptions, you deal with them as real. So, you know, moving forward, you know, how can you make them feel, you know, more included into, you know, their practice, having them report to the medical director, you know, and taking steps to create a more professional environment for them. It's another opportunity for good work-life balance. So thank you. Those are the observations and recommendations for the operations and practice piece. And Dean will step in now, and he will talk about financial services.
Okay. I've got to get up and move around, and the commissioner said I could. So, financial services, the simple part in my small brain is I separate it in two different things. The first of which is accounting, okay? When I got to spend some time with Janice and Carrie And then look at the budgets and all the data that Carrie provided at several different times throughout the last few months, that I have found that accounting is kind of like my garage, where an accountant says there's a place for everything and everything in its place. And sometimes they get kind of militant about that, and there's good reason for that, because they have these guidelines, these principles that they follow. And I'm here to tell you, you got a couple of people extremely principled and extremely detailed, and that accounting part of it is very, very, very sound. Because that is so solid, your budgets are impeccable. I love the way the format is. They make sense. It is very, very clear to everybody who looks at that, and it is just impressive to no end. Now, the other part of what I think financial services comes out to be is a more strategic planning and measurement part. Budgets are great. I get them. I've seen the most beautiful budgets in the world. But me as an executive, I want to see what the actual performance is compared to those that budget plan, the financial plan. Then we can sit back and say, why did we plan correctly? What happened? What are these variances and that sort of thing? When I got involved in healthcare administration in 1990, we were making this transition to where we focused on volume, we focused on revenue per visit, patient, discharge, whatever you want to make that denominator, but also what the expense was. I've had a lot of even anesthesiologists say, you're not going to be happy until we're all CPAs. And it's not that. It's just that our responsibilities as clinicians have evolved over time, because basically the way I look at it is healing is an art. Started long, 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 long time ago when we first lived in caves as human beings. Second part of that is medicine is a science. That's why I got involved in it. I'm enamored by it. I'm enamored by the complexity of it and the way it all works. Third part of that, healthcare is a business. And that's where we've had a hard time transitioning to. And in the world of for-profit and not-for-profit healthcare, we've felt the pain, and it's partially responsible for some of this gray hair. But that being said, it is an evolution. And when we're asked, what can we do to prepare in the future, a little bit more of a focus on financial planning is where I'm coming from, or we're coming from. As Joan mentioned, several among the directors and the managers across the organization really believe that that is part of their job, is managing that business component of their area of responsibility. And I wish I could take that feeling and then inject it into the DNA of some of the people in the acute care setting. Because some of them don't get it because they don't want to. That isn't what I found here. So being able to bring out financial reports on a periodic basis and go over and say, here's budget, here's actual. Any questions? I mean, what happened between the two? Did we plan? Did we not expect that? Did we miss it? Something happened on the in the actual part that we could never foresee. There's no right answer. It's the process of that analysis. The beginning balance. Carrie probably is ready to hit me in the head with a brick, because that's a concept that I didn't get. And she instructed me that in county government, that beginning balance is what was left over the previous year, and oh my gosh, it goes out to the next year. It is what we planned, what we actually did, and it accounts for about $5 million a year over the past few years.
I'll get into that a little bit more. The budget numbers do not have a consistent methodology, resulting in many unit-level budgets zeroing out. It's not that they're inaccurate. It's a timing issue, and every organization across the board has that timing issue. What did we plan, and when did it happen? But we could do that a little bit better here. Quarter-to-quarter financials do not have a consistent methodology across the board. It's, again, it's managing expectations. You got a bunch of directors out there and managers that say, I need this information because it's important to my job, performance of my job. Here's where I come into the demonstrated need for more expertise. There is a need for what I just mentioned, that strategic planning component of it. And that being able to find someone or send Carrie to the Wharton School of Business in Philadelphia. I don't think she's open for that. But the thing is to bring that level of experience in here. And I think that you guys are going to be the benefactor of that, and there's several ways of doing that. I found no evidence of financial reports such as income statements, balance sheets, cash flow statement. That may be a little bit aggressive in trying to think about the future. But again, that was what our task was, to say, how do we prepare ourselves? And the thing is, with the quality of this system, this county, it's attainable. Little evidence of communication of financial performance to the leadership team. That comes with that periodic report and that expectation coming out. And when those don't come out, you don't have as much of an opportunity for education. People beg for it, even though it's sometimes boring. Okay, another, there's the desire to be more aware of financial performance. We talked about administrative services chargeback, and Carrie explained that to me, that she, Janice, they allocate that expense back to the individual service lines, which is beautiful. There's the beginning balance, and then this is really, really important. The cash position of the organization has to be verified before this new building gets built. But I think everybody we talk to knows that. Recommendations provide financial management expertise. However, that you find to do that. Revise the structure and the processes necessary, establishing stable and up-to-date financial reports. It doesn't have to happen monthly. It can start out in quarterly, but here's where the deadline is. This is when these reports are coming out. Volumes. This is really, really critical. And when an administrative type, like I say something about productivity, people go, well, what do you don't think that I'm doing my job? Well, no, it doesn't mean anything about it. When you start looking at volumes coming into these service lines, you can actually start planning resources better to support that volume. And Kronos is that's why I'm so feverish about Kronos, is their analytics module is the best I've ever seen. And it really helps with this planning process, because if you can't plan it, the tail's wagging the dog. Increased collaboration, communications. I think once that's there, that communication will take place. And it's a way to develop future leaders as well, because that business component of it, even, you know, I've seen people that are good clinicians and they're moved into a management position. I go, I didn't sign up for this. Well, if you can educate them, start that career ladder, that's great for the future too. Electronic opportunities in finance and business. There are so many education components out there. I've taken classes at Harvard on philosophy, on strategy, on justice, as a matter of fact. And if I can do it, trust me. Billing and reimbursement is a part of financial services, and I had to point this group out. and I don't even know if there's anybody in the room from there, and I don't want to embarrass anybody. We were extremely impressed with this group. They are experienced. There seemed to be a very, very good relationship, and Carrie wasn't in the room at the time. There was a good communication relationship between this group, incredibly important group of people, with the finance department, and more importantly, they spoke to the relationship they have with the clinicians. These folks are bringing the clinicians along to help them do their jobs. Most organizations don't get that. And I'm telling you, couldn't talk about them the most. Brought a certified coder into the building sometime in the last year or two. She's not only a go-getter, that everybody has a goal within the department to become certified. And I'm one that's got a lot of initials after his name. You'll never see it, but I do. And that kind of education doesn't mean everything, but that means something. So it's just, I was inspired, and I think Joan was too, about this group. The challenges, just like in all billing and reimbursement, Medicare and its complex processes for filing. Not only is it complicated, it changes all the time. And from an old-timer that's been in this business, I don't foresee that changing anytime soon. In fact, it's going to get more complicated the next 5, 10, 20 years. The CCO changes their electronic claims acceptance system, so not only is Medicare changing all the time, one of the most important things to the survival of, or the business of HHS is the CCO. And not only do they keep track of the Medicare changes, they also keep track of the local changes within the state of Oregon. And then here's that part about clinical documentation being a challenge, but again, I got to emphasize that important relationship that those guys have with those people on the, that's actually taking care of patients. They spoke very, very intelligently about the electronic medical record in the financial dashboard, that it's that's already there. And impressive EHR and then the tools associated with it. The HRSA guidelines are very detailed and structured. That's not a complaint. It is one of those things that is really, really clear. And when I get down into the external stakeholders, that's a key area where Lincoln, Benton, and Linn County can set this state on fire. You got good partners out there. The other thing that I, as an executive in a healthcare organization, I stay up late at night worrying about what we didn't do from a service component. Finance was no different. Carrie told me of audits that takes place not only through the HRSA, but from the state and the federal. And I am at a comfort level like nobody's business because you don't get through an audit without having a solid, solid foundation going forward. In fact, I asked her for some data, and she says, I can't get to this right now. I'm going through an audit right now. And it happens periodically, and I think it's pretty successful. Okay. Oh, and then our certified coder that got hired, she also does internal audits of the staff on an individual basis. Did I mention how good they are? Recommendations, assist the staff in the effort to achieve certification. Great benefits package here, great organization, but pushing this and then getting out of the way in order for them to accomplish this. Not only does this group benefit, but it kind of is contagious across the organization, I think. Increase efforts to educate staff regarding financial operations, that's a consistent theme. Continue to remote presence in clinics for patient and staff access. The new building. I can't remember the young lady that was up in the Lincoln City facility. She was connected.
to that staff up there, to the patient population. Just amazing. So any new building, the clinicians, some of the administrative staff need that expert as close to the patient as possible. So when you're building a building, you don't have to move all the building over there. They could stay where they are. But I didn't say that. But being close to the patients where they can find somebody with those kind of questions, it's an imperative. And you guys are already thinking about that. Coordinate the provider and payer process so collections are appropriate for the services rendered. They're on top of it. So let's talk about payer mix. And acute care, we talk about payer mix. And in county government, through my education, we talk about funding sources. Basically the same thing. So this is a graph of the total funding sources. And if you notice that, forget about the miscellaneous for now, but the Medicaid right there, 31.3% of an annual basically revenue of $25.8 million, that's a huge part. So what are we going to focus on the next 5 to 10 years, especially when we just passed a tax reform bill that hadn't been paid for yet? Where's that money going to come from? Medicaid, Medicare, it's on somebody's target. But the thing is, who's going to take care of this population if we're reducing resources in that regard? Who's going to take that on? I'll get to that. Up here in Medicare is 1.3%. Oops, sorry. 1.3% of HHS's total funding source. To me, that's an opportunity. Needs to be a little bit of competition because of the quality of care that Joan mentioned, in particularly primary care and mental health, can increase this number. In competing with, I hope there's no Samaritan, well, it doesn't matter if Samaritan's in here or not. That is one avenue for people to come to. And HHS isn't for poor people. It's not. And in fact, one of the external stakeholders, and I'll say this now, I won't do it then, but I asked, I think it was Linn County's administrative director, after we were done with the questionnaire and talked for a little bit, what's your goals? He said, I want to have, this is his background, his mental health, I want the best mental health services in the state of Oregon. And me, at the end of the day, I kind of, oh, well, that's a great goal to have. He goes, you didn't hear me. In the state of Oregon, including for-profit, not-for-profit organizations, private practice, everything. I went, wow. And guess what? I believed him. So that vision will mold the future of HHS in Lincoln County, not only because you got the horsepower in regards to the vision part of it, but also you got partners in Linn and Benton County that, I'm telling you, I'd be their best friend. So miscellaneous, this big 38.6% of the original data that I got from Cary, I'm going, what? That's a lot of money. So taking that $9.6 million and broke it out into this, and look what's there, the beginning balance of 52%. So if my math is right, that's around $5 million a year. So somebody in the Board of Commissioners or Wayne or somebody that's interested, will that continue in the next few years? And the answer is maybe. Because, as Joan mentioned, there's 30-odd positions open in mental health. What happens? All those people get hired. What happens? This number, it goes down, unless it's made up somewhere else. That's a part of that financial management that
is not only critical, there's out there that love it. As weird as that sounds. Here is the administrative services chargeback. And again, if I'm writing financial reports, that beginning balance is retained earnings. That's money in the bank. That doesn't have anything to do with operations. This is money I put away. This is the money I hide from my wife every year. I put it in a different thing. And I say, this is a fund that we're going to use for capital, for emergencies, for this, for this, for this. That's a part of the budgeting process. And then this administrative services chargeback, all Jan and Carrie are doing is saying, we have all this administrative expense and we're allocating it to where the revenue is being generated. It's perfectly normal and it's done very, very well. And then these are other parts of that, which are many. Okay, let's talk about the project, which was at the first and foremost on everybody's mind when we were brought in here. So what we're looking at is basically, and that this one is, this first slide is a scenario that Wayne gave us direction on. This building's $18.6 million. Okay? The 45,000 square foot building. Beautiful drawings, by the way. Anybody had any thing to do with that? Magnificent drawings. But the loan, $18.6 million over 30 years at 4% interest, that total loan payment on an annual basis is just over $1 million. And every month, somebody's getting a check for $88,943. So the general fund contribution, as it is now, is $300,000 a year or $25,000 a month. This is the number that we focus on right here. How much does HHS have to contribute on an annual basis and a monthly basis in order to fund that building for the next 30 years? It's broken down that way. Square footage of 45,000, and that comes out to $414 per square foot. Now me, as a consultant, and as someone experienced in building expensive buildings, the average for a clinic office building or a medical clinic office building is $228 to $387 a square foot. I got the documentation. It's all ready for anybody to look at. And then how much of that is furniture and equipment included? These are the things that a good building developer or planner will work with Cheryl, a team, get their input, and then basically say what it includes and what it doesn't include. And I'm sure that they've done a lot of work with that. Here's the assumptions. For that 30-year loan at 4% interest, that's a $13.4 million interest. Not much flexibility with that. But with that being said, of that $63,000 $63,000 a month and $767 for the year, what comes out of that is this rental that you got that HHS is paying every year, $204,000. They offset each other a little bit, not one for one, but it's money that could be saved. So this next model basically takes that $18.6 million over a 40-year loan at 3.5%. Let's just say we want to extend it out beyond what we think is the useful life of that building. And just like a lot of people take a car loan out for 10 years, how does that impact? And you will notice that the monthly payment total, $72,000, goes down to about 20-something thousand. That means something, especially in daily or in operations on a monthly basis. But look what it does to the interest. That goes from $13 million to $16 million over that 40-year period. again, when we start looking at this in a level of detail that it requires, that's a decision that has to be made. All the other things remain the same. These are the financial assumptions for the loan period, and this my analysis came from the loan or the submission to the for the loan in the first place. So I noticed that when we look at that 2020 number that was supplied, I started questioning some things, and it's a leveling off of intergovernmental, the federal grants and contracts revenue over that time period, an increase of 4.5% in the fee for services. That was in that. That's an expectation. And what I want to know is, how do we do that? What happens with it? So over that time period, a 5% annual increase in Medicaid, and then a 3% increase in Medicare. So you guys are on the same page as I am. Let's increase that Medicare number revenue and capitalize on that patient population. There's no subsequent increase in miscellaneous revenue. The beginning balance stayed the same, about $5 million a year. But again, it's not being impacted by changes in the organization, filling the vacancies, buying of equipment, and all that sort of thing. But it's very well managed. Here's the one thing that I noticed that I brought to the attention, 7.3 decrease in operating expenses. How's that going to happen? That's why I'm here. I'm pesty and all that sort of thing. The other thing I noticed is Medicare is currently 13.2% of the total funding sources, and by 2020, it's projected to drop to 11%. The other thing that we were asked to do is look at what's happened in healthcare and what's going to be, what do we think is going to happen in the next few years. Extremely humbling experience, almost unnerving. But I've split this out to what I think in regards to the national level, and then the next slide is the state level. There's no doubt about it, in my mind, that the Affordable Care Act didn't go anywhere. Because guess what? You repeal the Affordable Care Act, you better replace it with something. And even though a certain party has been talking about it since its implementation, there's no easy solution to it. But it will continue to be altered, and I changed this language on... somebody gave me their opinion. I should change that language, and it said it will continue to be altered, which ever since the election, it started. Starting chipping away at it. My personal opinion is increased privatization and deregulation of Medicaid and Medicare. We're going to constantly come back to that because the free enterprise system, it is believed by some that will work for everything. They're going to keep talking about it, but not quite sure that they can do anything about it in the next 10 to 20 years. Medicaid shift to block grant program, giving states more autonomy, but lower funding levels. I had written this in this slide, and not even 3 weeks later, President Trump said those words about the block grant program. And we're not connected. Changes in the payment models. This is one thing when I got into hospital administration in the 90s. There is a part of CMS called the Center for Medicare, Medicaid Innovation. These guys are a think tank and says, we appreciate that the government is paying for this for our citizens, but we got to continue to get buy-in from these organizations and risk sharing. And back in the 90s, there was a demonstration project where a hospital that participates in it got a global fee for a total joint and got a global fee for a open heart. That's what, there's no negotiation. That's what you're going to get from Medicare. But guess what? at the end of the year, the money that you saved, the system, you split with Medicare. That incentivized everybody involved in order to be the most efficient, more efficient, and keep it as just as effective. That's not going to go away. There's going to be more stressing of that particular concept, I think. Reinstatement of disproportionate share hospital funding for treatment of uninsured individuals. Affordable Care Act kind of took the heat off of hospitals for a little bit, okay, because they saw a lot of uninsured people that they wrote off or got credit for or some other things that not-for-profit and for-profit care go through. This disproportionate share hospital funding, now hospitals are going to start hitting that a little bit more. Because the more, there's one thing that isn't going to happen, and that's insurance companies take a loss. So they're going to raise their rates. People are going to decide they can't afford it. If they do away, did they do away with the mandatory insurance coverage? Where are those people going to go? Our friends in acute care. Now they're going to start hitting the government and say, you need to bring this back because we're taking a bath. Payors, all of them, Medicare and, I already talked about Medicare and Medicaid. Payors will continue to take aggressive action to preserve their margins. I'll stop right there. I'll end it. In 2014, Oregon received approximately $7 billion in Medicaid funding. Keep that in mind. State, they are talking about this House Bill 2391, and it's going to be voted on 2 weeks. And basically, it's a 1.5% tax on health care insurers' earnings to help pay for the Medicaid that's offered in the state. And in addition to that, 0.7% tax on hospital net revenue. Hospitals starting to get hammered. The risk in defeat, $210 to $320 million for a three-year period between 2017 and 2019. But the one that's coming from the state of Oregon, but here, $630, $960 million in matching federal funds. So I had to write all this down with it and do a calculator. What it basically means is the state of Oregon, $280 to $426 million in a potential annual decrease in Medicaid funding. Somewhere in there. Potential. The estimate in 2016, Medicaid paid out $8.4 billion to Oregon. Remember in 2016 it was $1.4 billion increase in 2 years. Medicaid's not going anywhere. And then varying opinions expressed about referendum passing. And then the subsequent consequences. I had heard that the governor said, doesn't matter what the referendum did, we'll make Medicaid whole. That sort of this comes from a good authority. And the thing is that we're always going to be creative with Medicaid funding because there's no alternative but one. Recommendations, continued further analysis in relation to the size of the building, actual space utilization needs. 45,000 square feet, I'd need to see the facility plan in order to feel good about that, but that's me. One recommendation is to include a phased-in building plan approach to this project, because what we do in hospitals we shell out space that we think we're going to use, and then as we use it, we finish that shell space out with, you know, more expensive finishings and all that sort of thing as we go along. So that's an alternative, and we made that suggestion as well. Create a detailed volume, revenue, and expense pro forma, including all assumptions over the length of the proposed loan. To me, that's a little bit aggressive, especially when you're talking about 40 years. Who knows what 40 years could be? But the first 10 years of this loan period, it ought to have exactly how much money that we're expecting, how much expense, I mean line item. And Carrie and Janice know what I'm talking about. Get that kind of level of detail for every year, the first 10 years of that loan period. And that way, you can say, this year, how did we do? Next year, that year, do we have to adjust? Do we have to put a little bit more money in that account that I hide from Barbara in order to make sure that the subsequent years are taken care of? And then the detail. If we're expecting a 7.3% reduction in operating expenses, how are we going to do that? Is the building going to be so efficient that it's going to make the practitioners' lives easier? We can put a number to that. A number can be put on that. And just like everything else, that's a given. Operating expense compared to annual revenue. And then get your best negotiator, whoever that is, and negotiate that price of square footage. And it ought to be down around $300 per square foot. And the research that I did, that 400 and, what did I say, $440 a square foot, that's hospital construction prices. Okay? And I don't know if you guys are putting operating rooms and cat labs in this building, but that's where the money is in regards to a hospital, is that kind of support space. I put it right there. $380 to $525 per square foot to build a hospital in Portland. You're not going to get much more granular than that. I found this article that was just published too. Facilities. What are you building the building in the first place? Joan mentioned it a couple of times. Everybody mentioned it from the 10 days that we spent here. Everybody. Nobody said, oh no, this is fine. So I think it's great that you guys are exploring this and the level of detail that you were giving it. The health system has 7 buildings basically providing direct health care. You guys all know that in sports services. These are the highlights that we pointed out: inadequate office space and meeting space. This isn't a matter of me not having my own private office. It is a practitioner having a private conversation with a patient. It's imperative. From a lot of different aspects. Small crowded offices, poor flow patterns, poor. Try to make do in the 210, the Nyack building.
Western Title.
Well, Western Title. Yeah, IBD and Western Title. Don't say that. Lincoln City. Lincoln City's really nice. As far as patient flow and amount of space, there's an allocation of space issue, which I'm going to get into in a minute. But the lack of privacy and confidentiality, not only from a clinical aspect, from a financial aspect as well, because we don't need to talk about our own personal business in front of everybody. It's an imperative. Inadequate lining, poor ventilation, that's all things that are easily remedied, whether it's a new building or not. We had to mention again about the high school sites. I was inspired. And not only with the facilities and the students that we got to meet, which were cool, but the staff there from a mental health standpoint, from a primary care and the support. amazing. Great deal of competition. This happens at every organization I've ever had anything to do with. Allocation of space. And I'm going to get to a recommendation, but master plan for the space allocation. What my biggest fear is, you build a 45,000 square foot building with no improvement in the process of space allocation, going to have the same problems
in the new building.
In a brand new building. Fix the process before you move in.
Dean, one of the things about the inadequate office, behavioral health particularly mentioned group. Enough rooms for their group meetings.
Yes. I think I covered that, or we covered that in this upcoming.
Okay. But
that is absolutely right. Recommendations. We're already at recommendations. This is my deal, because I've lived it. I've lived the pain. Appointing a facilities coordinator. Needs somebody detailed, knows the organization, owns these buildings, basically, because not only do they know the square footage and they're able to allocate, it's a lot like materials management. There's aggressive people in materials management that know where things need to be, when they need to be there, and why they're used. That mentality, and I'm hinting at a person personally, is that they'd make a great facility coordinator. Know it. Understand it, not afraid to make a decision about it. And clinicians, just like all the rest of us human beings, can plead our case and get granted something without the entire organization in mind. And it's a headache. And I'm going to go back to data. This isn't a one-time thing. It needs to be monitored, at least on a quarterly basis. How are we utilizing space? And those of us who spend a lot of time in operating rooms, surgeons fight over how much space they have, how much time they have, all this kind of stuff. If you rely on data and you can show a surgeon, here's how much time you operated in this quarter, here's your allocation to your block time, what is the argument? Can't argue with data, unless you're a statistician. The conditions of the buildings. I was impressed. Now I walk into Third Lincoln City, I'm starting to write notes. Some paint, some lighting, the kids area, that sort of thing. But somebody, and maybe it's this facility coordinator, and the staff ought to say, I want this done like tomorrow. It's not as much about whether the paint's in a good condition or not. What image are we portraying the community? Every staff member ought to own that building. And I'm not talking about picking up gum wrappers. I'm talking about, does this really illustrate the quality of services that we offer? And even though a brand new building is being considered, that philosophy ought to extend. It's going to look great. Administrative support. We always forget the administrative support in equipment storage. Oh, well, we'll figure out where to put that. That means somewhere down the road, it's in the hallway somewhere. And I've seen Rebecca, Carol, Cheryl, Barb, enough to know that's going to wear them out, is walking into a brand new building and see this cluttered up. And then the other thing is that I've noticed the clinical staff, they may quit saying anything about it, but it puts them under stresses they don't need. So it's something. Critical factors, the project lead is incredibly important. Whoever's designated to do that, comprehensive assessment of current space and needs, I said that, needs assessment to the findings, and everybody wants to participate in this, but what I found with clinicians and people at work, and even surgeons, they're asked their opinion, and it doesn't turn out the way they want. What do you think they say? What'd you ask me for? The thing is, asking your opinion, being asked your opinion in decision making, two different things. Sometimes the democracy doesn't exist, and especially with space. Project timeline communication is extremely important. We mentioned that, what to expect, and then the collateral services. External stakeholders. The detailed report, I don't know how many different slides it is, maybe 30. But what we basically did was we came up with six standardized questions, ran them by Cheryl to make sure that they were okay, and I asked every external stakeholder the same question. And I noted their responses. The second part of it was kind of a freelancing, give me an idea, and we have supplied all that data. And this one slide, number 54, is basically what that process was all about. The timeline, 27 external stakeholders were talked to. Excuse me. And they range from everybody from members of Samaritan Health to local and regional similar mental health facilities, primary care, and that sort of thing. And then also, we got a list of people that the Board of Commissioners, Cheryl, Wayne, thought were important to talk to. So it's pretty comprehensive. And that 27 was a part of an initial list of 32, which I nagged and nagged and nagged for the others, and just didn't find the time, or my email went to their junk. So it's a good sampling. Feedback, the main thing. Access to services due to a lack of resources is a primary challenge to the system. And a lot of things are associated with that. And it's not just open positions. It's transportation. It's all these other factors that keep people from getting the care that they need. A lot of opportunity there. Services and quality are not well known in the community. One of my questions was, how much do you think the community is aware of the services provided by HHS and the quality that they deliver? And there's a lot of opportunity there to brag a little bit. And my thing is, you set it up to where you let your organization know what kind of work that you do, and then how well you do it, and take that message out into the community. And I'm not talking about billboards, because I'm not a big fan of that, but I'm talking about promoting the work that you guys are doing in this county, because you could do it. Mental health and addiction services will continue to plague the county, meaning there's always going to be a business for it. And so it's just the reality of it. So how do we handle that? And what resources can we get Barb and her team in order to pull that off? Because just like the guy in Linn County, there's a lot of opportunity there, because mental health across the country, I think, could stand some work. Leadership, culture, and history have to open it. A lot of the culture and history, there needs to be some work on overcoming that. Because they don't know, outside the organization, what I just said, the progress that you've made. Mike's addition to personnel and the systems that are in place. A lot of things are happening in this HHS. It needs to be out there. Demographic trends. There is no doubt your community needs assessment is amazing. Just like Samaritan Health, because I looked at theirs too. Huh? Oh, sorry. I thought you wanted me to say something. But we included this, and we included it from our own research, so we're adding to the already copious amount of research that you guys have already done. population decline in the county, but there's a growth in immigration. Don't foresee that changing much in the future. Aging population. It's a retirement community here. That's not going to change. It's going to continue to go up. The takeaway, anticipate continued growth in retired groups and continued decline in the working ages with flat numbers in the pediatric population. Community service needs. The Lincoln County has got some of the poorest population and less healthy in the entire state. That's nothing new. We heard that time and time again, and the data support that. The rate of insured has declined significantly since the passage of the ACA. We talked about that today already. Higher needs in the community from county agency. The opportunity is not only going to continue to be there, it's going to be greater. Prenatal and pediatric needs, 40% of children are below the poverty level in Lincoln County. And basically the takeaway, the population is flat, but there is a continuing need to grow pediatric and prenatal outreach. And the great thing about maternal child health, those people are into this. That's a high point of HHS is that group. They're very, very aggressive. They know their stuff, and they're not willing to say, oh, well, that's just Lincoln County. They're after it. Diabetes and mental health needs. The takeaway is a need for more focused resources in both diabetes and mental health. And I think we could switch those two. Mental health is going to be huge in the future. Project summary. There is no doubt about it. HHS can't go anywhere. That's one of our main things. Reimbursement trends for the services are positive, but the future environment is going to be more focused on dollars expended and value of services provided. I asked most of the clinicians after in those talks, I'm the administrator, I'm going to ask the nasty question. How do you know that there's value in the services you provide? What can I look at and say, all this volume, all this effort that you guys are making an impact in this county? And guess what? They weren't stumped. They gave me metrics that I never thought of, and I'm a nerd. So the thing is, it's there. Have to write it down and say, here's the improvements that we've made. The foundations are strong for system and process improvement. Strategic planning is critical in moving forward and assessing current service lines and future business opportunities. And leadership development is key. And one person. It isn't just these guys. It's the entire organization, because you got to be thinking about who is going to step up to lead in the future. Grow your own. Every effort should be taken to improve the environment for the staff. They will make or break any healthcare organization. And no, they are not the same as other employees in the county, and that's okay. That's okay. Collaboration with the healthcare community should be strategic objective, especially with the three county consortium. I would wear those people out. I copy and steal everything that they've done. I wouldn't make any bones about it. I wouldn't reinvent it. I'd do something with them. They were inspiring to me, every one of them I talked to. And then back to this, increase the promotion of the positive impact that this organization has given this county. Start internally, take it externally, get somebody that can talk to just about anybody to promote what's going on. It's unique, but it's nothing that you guys, what the future could be.
That's it.
I want
Well, there may be questions from the commissioners, so we'll ask you to...
I thought that was too easy.
Well, nice try. I'll give you credit there.
Didn't work.
First of all, the fact that you were here 10 days, I think is pretty evident from the presentation that you were very busy and worked very hard. So thank you for that. And commissioners, questions? Terry.
I've got several questions, but first of all, you showed the graphs of what direct service providers and then percentage for management and the three groups you broke out.
Mm-hmm.
You do this all over the country. What's normal? You never did say what is normal. But our situation...
Let me speak to that.
Yeah. Well, actually, we were asked that at one of our reviews of it. And what I told... it was Michael and Wayne that was on the call. And we can, and we'll provide that for you. There isn't, we can say the standard for, staff in an operating room is X number.
We should be able to come up with a standard.
We will, exactly.
Actually, I'd like to break it broke down by each of the three divisions you talked about.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the recommendations we had is that strategic staffing analysis, and all that information could and would be included in that. So when you're looking at an X number of FTEs, there'd be a benchmark, because we talked about benchmarks in the report, because we didn't see, strength in current benchmarks. And so there would be benchmarks for what would be the optimum percent for direct care, what would be an optimum percent for, management and or support staff. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
But Mr. Thompson, the first thing that we would do is validate those percentages. Because, not that I don't believe the data, but getting down to what constitutes an administrative FTE. The direct caregiver is relatively easy, but then that management component of it, we would verify that first. And like Joan says, compare that to that experience and that sort of thing, and then ask the staff, where is the pressures from and where does this come from and how could we do it better? Because to say, it's got to be 20% management across the board, it really depends. But we'd have to dig into that a little bit.
Okay. I'm involved with the school, or was for quite a while, with school healthcare clinics, and I agree with you. We have an unusual situation. We are not getting credit for what we're doing and respect around the state of the things that is involved with that. And I particularly like what you said. We need to toot our own horn about some of the things we're doing better than a lot of other places in the state, because the whole state has a problem that needs to be addressed, not just Lincoln County. And if we're doing it better, we need to tell the story. So I really appreciated that part of it. Of course, there is no answer to the future with Medicare exactly.
No.
But I appreciated your comments there also. So thank you.
Just a few observations, and really appreciate your work, the depth of it. Lots of takeaways. This landed on our desks a week ago today. I've been studying the document intensely ever since. I had some questions that your presentation has answered. I appreciate that. I'm glad to see such a strong presence from HHS staff as well as community stakeholders here today, and I hope that very important takeaway gets hammered home to everyone, the breadth and quality of services that we're delivering. This is especially helpful, I think, in wrapping my mind around the question that moved us into this review process in the first place, whether the numbers hold up and we can find the financial justification for what we know is justified from a service need to make this commitment to an $18 million building project. Just for a little context, that not everyone may be aware of, the largest capital project this county has ever undertaken was construction of that jail next door 28 years ago at a cost of $8 million. And we're looking at obligating the county for an $18 million project with a 30 to 40 year payoff. So, you know, as this your presentation has made clear, we can never have the perfect crystal ball, but I just want to make sure, as this board makes the final decisions on that project, that we're doing it with the strongest justification that we can find.
Yeah.
Well, I think where you ended is probably where I'll start. I'm a banker, and numbers are important to me, and again, I think the primary motivator in starting this process was the project. And, you know, how do you take all those factors and look into the future and make decisions that don't prove to have unintended consequences in the future? It's easy to make decisions, but we need to make the right decisions. So lots of good data here. The other thing I'd like to say is when we first started this process, I think there was a feeling amongst many that you know, this was going to be a witch hunt, that it was out to, you know, tear things down and be very negative. And I think people were worried about, you know, wholesale job losses, you know, back to the Depression. Well, almost a depression. Some of the long-term benefits or consequences. Anyhow, the recession. And I think this is a very balanced report, and I commend you for that. And as Commissioner Thompson said, we need to do a better job of talking about the great things that we do. So I thank you for that. I have a couple of specific questions. I'll start out with an easy one, and I'll look to Mike in the back. The analytics model in Kronos, are we purchasing it?
Yeah, the analytics?
Yes.
I'm going to say I think so, but I'm not positive.
I actually talked to Janice. I whispered to her as it was presented, and I don't think that's actually part of the package.
The problem that we have to do with Kronos is that we've got to buy it incrementally.
Yeah.
And the decision that we made was to try to have an entry point that wasn't going to overwhelm us, because it's a big project for us, and we took the compensation package because we needed it just to be able to have some benchmarking. We know, we've looked at it. The question is, you know, how much are we going to add to it? We know that the initial entry point, though, it's not going to stop there.
Okay.
We'll grow as we
phasing.
Learn.
Well, go ahead, Joan Dean.
So he's talking about phasing it in.
Right.
You know, get it up and running, work out the kinks, and then look to funding and the timeline for the analytics.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Dean.
But you don't have to wait for the analytics module.
That's where I was going.
Because the volume of workload is the most important thing. And when I see the three service lines and the numbers, and I go, look at public health, it's so low. Well, that's patient visits. That's not encompassing everything that group does. And Rebecca's staff, we were talking about it, and I said, I want to know what are all these restaurant surveys and inspections that you guys do? How much time does that take? How much time in preparation? The phone calls that they get constantly, that all is a workload. That's their contributions. That's what Kronos will make easier for you, but you can get in the habit. I want to know what everything that's going on in these facilities by the department level, and then what kind of workload is being expended to give people credit, number one, and secondly, put the resources behind it. Kronos will give you the analytics that make it standardized, comparisons to other facilities that are part of that group, but you don't have to wait for that.
Well, could we make it a priority to ask staff to at least bring us information on what the cost would be and what steps would be entailed in implementing that module?
Sounds like a good idea to me. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason I asked the question started there is, your presentation had many parts that talked about data and collecting the data and using the data to make decisions, and I see Kronos as being a part of that, and I think being data-driven is certainly a sound process. But I also think that with the advances in technology and the availability of technology to support the services that we provide, there's opportunities for cost savings and to do a better job. So I see Kronos and the analytics as part of that. Now I'll ask once...
Mr. Chair, before you move off that, can I make one more observation?
Certainly, ma'am.
It was an aha moment at a training I attended a couple of years ago, which should seem obvious, but I think another element why this will be so important to us in what's an increasingly competitive funding environment, one of the speakers said, you can get funded the first time on the strength of an idea, but if you want ongoing funding, you better have the data to show the results.
Yeah.
So, all right, and then I'm interested in the position control discussion, but I am sure that I'll be able to gather some additional knowledge about that outside of this venue. So, if there are no more questions from commissioners, I'm sorry, Dean, go ahead.
Just one brief comment about that. There is a very robust position control system. It's don't want to say that there's no checks and balances to it, because there's a lot of scrutiny paid to any open position in it. So that's a part of it, but it's what Joan and I are getting at is, just like an org chart, there are FTEs associated with each one of these service lines, and that's a part of the resource that needs to be managed. And that is a fluctuating thing on a periodic basis,
a regular basis,
from quarter to quarter, month to month, and maybe even week to week, that workload.
Truly.
So that's what we're talking about. These guys have a great system in place of approvals, and you don't ask for an open position unless you've done your homework. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Commissioner Thompson. This open position thing is, you said it was common in all the organizations around the United States, and you've done this for a long time. What have you seen out there that helps close that deficit?
It's not the weather in Lincoln County. Even though I see these people again that I met a couple of months ago. Well, you saw the worst about Lincoln County now, and this is the way it is. Look, I look forward to coming here. It's not the weather. It's not the patient population. It's not the pay rates. It's a combination of all those things. There's no doubt about it. But that will never replace a solid organization for professionals to grow professionally and personally. And take it from somebody that recruited 60 nurse practitioners and physician's assistants to Toledo, Ohio. I doubt if anybody in this room goes to Toledo for a vacation.
Well, now wait, there's Toledo, Oregon, 7 miles down the road.
We were just there today on a little drive. But it's a combination of things, Terry, and it comes from, this is such a great organization and it has the potential to get even greater. That's what will bring professionals in here.
Excellent point.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions from the commissioners? Again, I thank you very much for your hard work, and there's a lot of information there and lots for us to consider as we move forward, and your help is greatly appreciated, and your information will be a big part of that process in the future.
So thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think we should have a couple of questions.
Okay, we're going to excuse them.
You can come up and sit up here.
Sit up here, and then we have, I haven't forgotten, we'll have opportunities for anybody who would like to have comment to come forward. I don't know, I believe a few people have signed in. After that, if you want to come forward, that's fine. Again, please keep your comments to a maximum of 5 minutes. And again, probably don't need to say this, but we ask that your comments be related to the Soaring Consulting Report and the information that was presented this afternoon. Can I get the list of people that signed in, please?
Good afternoon. I'm Gerald Stanley. I'm a citizen in the county. I am the vice president of the Lincoln Community Health Center and have been past president and been on that board for about 10 years. I have three very brief comments and one which I find worrisome. The first comment simply, and I think we've mentioned this briefly on page 8, when we list community issues, I'm always a little worried when the school district gets focused on, and I'd like to see that document made fuller with each, issues of retail services, transportation, and weather as issues in our difficulty with succeeding. The second comment is on page 13 of the under personnel, and under the title of problems with the clinical and professional staff, we see that LCHC is a union environment. As a retired union person, I find that intriguing, if not threatening. I also find it very typically Oregon as well, the attitude toward unions, why this does not say a strength rather than a challenge. And the third comment, which is really problematic to me, and that's on page 11, and if you'd look at this one, if you can get it, I think we need to look at the sentence itself. It's the second to the last bullet. I didn't say before, and I meant to say it, that the Lincoln Community Health Council co-manages with the Board of Commissioners a significant percentage of the medical programs here under a $1 million grant from the federal government. This particular bullet on page 11 is the only mention of this in the whole report of the FQHC. It says, medical staff are currently reporting to the Community Health Division Director. No, I don't mean this in a contentious way. It's not the correct designation of her job. But if I'm hearing here, for efficiency's sake, that people are going to report more directly up above the Community Health Division Director, then I'm wondering if we're going to violate the $1 million grant. And I think that's very important to look at. The rules of that grant are quite particular about how all this runs, as I'm sure you know. So I have a real worry about how this is going to work while we try to respect the regulations of the grant.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for your comments. I have Barbara and Steve. I saw Steve's hand up. We'll have Barbara go next.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Barbara Fry. I live at 410 East 2nd Street, Yahats. I'm currently a member of the Lincoln Community Health Center's Council. I rise to speak today as a South County resident, however, and a registered nurse of over 40 years who spent over 20 years, the last 20 years of my career, as the director of the largest nurses union in Washington State. In that capacity, I supervise the negotiations and contract administration of collective bargaining agreements with the majority of public and private hospitals, county health districts and departments, outpatient clinics, jail health facilities, and public health departments, both large and urban, or tiny and rural, throughout the state of Washington. I became very familiar with the struggles of public health, and when I say public health, I mean all the facets, not just as we call public health. I became really familiar with those struggles as virtually every agency experienced declining funding, reductions in services, and layoffs at the same time. That services, demand for services grew and grew. I know Oregon has experienced the same assault in the same period. I saw firsthand the critical need for the range of services that publicly funded health agencies provide, everything from primary health care, mental health care, immunizations, public health and safety of food and water, community education, mother, baby, substance abuse, gambling addictions, clinics for school-age kids, and dozens more of essential services that the community needs. I've had the privilege of working with Lincoln County Community Health and Human Services. Their dedication to providing comprehensive health care for the neediest citizens in our community is simply extraordinary, in my experience. The challenge to provide care in rural communities are daunting and seem never-ending. The ability to recruit qualified providers and staff in this extremely competitive market in the United States is not unique to Lincoln County, of course, but it is more challenging in a rural, rainy area than some other places. It's unique. Staff work very, very hard at trying to be creative and innovative in getting the word out about what a great place this is to work and live and practice, and are very welcoming to applicants, but competing with the private sector for salaries and benefits and housing and working conditions are a formidable obstacle. Despite the challenges of limited resources, staffing challenges, and they're real, cramped, inadequate workspaces, difficulty in recruiting, and never-ending changes in the healthcare environment, I continue to be amazed by the dedication and commitment of all the staff. The determination to provide compassionate, competent, and comprehensive care never seems to waver. It's amazing. I've never heard a disparaging remark or a negative comment about the very needy and sometimes challenging populations they serve. Instead, problems are seen as challenges to solve, and they set about coming up with solutions. It's remarkable to see that in action. I believe the values, that the values of an organization come from the leaders at the top. They set the tone and expectations and foster the shape and behavior and attitudes of staff. I want to just take a minute to recognize a couple of the really great leaders you have here. Cheryl Connell, the Director of Health and Human Services, and I have worked closely for the past several years in trying to find ways to expand services to underserved areas of the county. Her vision and determination to provide quality professional programs is unwavering. Rebecca McBee Wilson, Executive Director of the Lincoln Community Health Centers, and Carol Hall, Nurse Executive, are just two of the really extraordinary leaders, and they handle amazing workload with competence and humor and grace. Lincoln County citizens are really lucky to have such quality leaders and staff. I've worked with a lot in my 40-plus years as a nurse, and I'll tell you, they're top-notch, and I feel privileged to have worked with them. One comment, when you talk about Kronos, I bet I've been involved with dozens. I know I've been involved with dozens of implementation of Kronos programs, and I urge you to don't be cheap on it. It will fail if you get the cheapest model. I've seen that happen again and again and again. So invest up front. It's a very, very big transition in my experience with public health and with hospitals and jails. It's a good system, but it can be incredibly disruptive and takes a lot of training, and the places that do it on the cheap, it inevitably has failed. So just that's my experience. So thank you for the opportunity to extol the virtues of our community health centers.
Thanks. Thank you for your comments. Somebody's glasses?
Mr. Sparks.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
I rarely get a chance to talk to all three of you at once. Thank you for that.
Well, thank you. You acknowledge that we are very cognizant of the public meeting rules.
So, yes, indeed. I have to make a couple of comments about the Soybean Report as it relates to the Stepping Up Initiative. I had the opportunity to spend considerable time with Dean on the phone and exchanging emails, and I've had now the chance to review this report, listen to everyone here, and what I want to say is that the Soybean Report reinforces virtually everything that we have done with the Stepping Up Initiative the last 18 months. So I would say that we've had a kickstart on a lot of these challenges and opportunities in the context of a couple of things, and I'll mention what they are. The most important ones first, and that's financial, Dean. We have learned that as we build up and become stronger as a county and more competitive, there are incremental funding opportunities out there. We have challenges going forward, and there are going to be some issues related to funding that we get now and incremental funding opportunities to make up for the gaps. So The other thing that in the report that's very, very significant to me, because I've been intimately involved with the Tri-County structure and the IHNCCO for the last 18 months, yes, we have great partners. There's a lot of value there, and if we work with our partners effectively, we're going to find incremental revenue, diversified funding streams with that as well. And yes, we have a great partner in Samaritan Health Services. Yes, again, the IHNCCO, a great partner. So the more we focus strategically connected, starting with the Stepping Up Initiative related to this, we can bring those two plans together, because the Soyring Report really reinforces what the three of you committed to almost 18 months ago in passing a resolution for the Stepping Up Initiative. And I've been, as a senior citizen in this county, my wife is here with me, Judy. We've lived here for 13 years now. We love the community. This is a great place for senior citizens. It's also been a great place for me to continue to practice some of my professional passion in terms of consulting. And we love this community. And I think we're taking some great steps forward, but strategic planning and collaborations and partners at the top of the list, in my view, as the project consultant for the Stepping Up Initiative. That's what we've learned. This reinforces it. And I'm just grateful that we're doing this and encouraged by all the work that we've done the last 18 months, especially. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to make a comment or two? All right. Seeing nobody come forward, again, I would like to say that certainly this report does a good job of reminding us of the great job that the Health and Human Services Department does, the great services that you're providing to our citizens, critically important services to our citizens. And again, I thank you all for that effort on behalf of our citizens. And with that, we are adjourned.